All right. Why don't we jump in here? I want to talk some Commandy.
Okie doke.
This whole city used to be filled with humans. Families, mothers, fathers. My grandfather worked for a secret organization. When the disaster struck, he sealed us in a protected chamber called Command D. And yeah, that's how I got my name. He and I were the last survivors. We stretched the supplies as long as we could. We had a few books, some info reels. He taught me all he could. Until he was my only companion. My only friend. His final words were, "You were the last boy on Earth, Commandy. For the sake of humanity, you must survive."
If we're going where I think we are, I doubt any of us will survive.
Journey with them now. Back to the bins.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Back to the Bins, where I, Paul Spataro, am joined by my good friend David Pascarella as two of the remaining speaking humans in the world who have survived the great disaster. What's up, Dave?
Same old stuff. How about you?
Well, other than the great disaster, all is good.
Well, I see we have a lot of fixer-upper opportunities.
And who's going to listen to this podcast after the disaster?
The apes, the rats, the tigers.
Oh, my.
Oh, my.
So if anybody doesn't get what we're talking about, if you listened when Dave and I recently covered a Brave and the Bold issue with Batman and Commandy, as we finished off the episode, we said, you know what? I want to take a closer look at Commandy. And we are going to be having an ongoing discussion where we do issue by issue through Commandy. So we're going to take a look. We had already done issue one a while back, maybe about 6 months ago. I don't even know, maybe a year ago, whatever the case may be. Issue number one was done. And we are now looking at issues two and three of Commandy. If you want, go ahead and read them and come back and join us. But if you don't want, we're going to synopsize them.
And just keep in mind, if you go to the last page of issue one, you get a lovely map of what the world looks like. Well, North America, basically. So you can follow along. Oh, that's all that's left?
All I know is New York. I just saw one of these things on one of the social medias where they had somebody talk about, you know, we're from New York, blah, blah, blah. And she was like, anything north of New York City, we kind of think you're Canada. And stuff like that she's saying. But, you know, we are egocentric and the world does revolve around us. But I am still two issues away from completing my Commandy run. But as we record this, our friends are down south in the Orlando area at MegaCon. And Scott just texted me about an hour ago saying, which issues of Commandy do you still need? So for all I know, I have a complete collection now.
How great would that be?
That would be very cool. It would be cosmic timing that we're doing our first episode of our retrospective and I complete the series at that time. But I'm not working off my issues, nor am I working off of virtual issues. I am working off of the archive volume one sent by friend of the show, Jason Sandberg, for my review. He sent me volume one and volume two of it. So I read it out of that for today.
Does that make up the whole collection? Two volumes?
No.
Oh, there's more.
No. Volume one brings us through.
I can't see how thick it is. That's why.
It's 10 issues.
Okay.
And I assume volume two is 10 issues also, but that's what I'll be working with as we're doing these. So that'll get me through issue 20, and then I might have to start cracking open the collection, most of which I bought for a dollar or less.
Did they actually do all the volumes, or is it projects where, we did half and we're going to stop?
I would guess that they did half and stopped, but I don't know for sure.
Because
the first couple issues, first couple of volumes are the ones that are going to make the money. And then after that, it's like, why are we going to bother?
Right. Yeah. So, get off my lawn.
Exactly. So looking, and just to show you how advanced I am here. When I did my synopsis, I actually did it on my computer. Wow, you did too. No handwritten synopsis this time.
No, this is all high class, high tech, since we're going into the Stone Age in this.
So I'm going to start with Commandee number 2, which is cover dated January of 1973. Basically, it's pretty much a Jack Kirby joint, with the exception of Mike Royer joining in to do the inking and the lettering. The cover has a shot of Commandee facing off against a masked and armed rat, and a human-sized rat at that, as several other rats are climbing on a rope from a dirigible, and there's a deep red background on the cover. The story is called The Year of the Rat, and it opens where issue one left off, with Commandee, together with Ben Boxer, who is a humanoid, and Dr. Canis, or Canis, I'm not sure, a talking anthropomorphized dog. They're looking out at human-sized rats who are an organized gang and offloading their crates of ill-gotten loot from the dirigible, as shown on the cover. So, there's a society of rats and a kingdom of tigers, and Commandee is just a touch perplexed. At this point, a tiger patrol makes their way into the lab where they're hanging out. They catch Ben off guard from behind, and then they pull off his radioactive shielding coveralls and press the button that's located at the heart on his suit, which sets off a minor explosion and converts Ben to a steel-plated being who quickly disposes of the tigers. Good move, tigers. At this juncture, Commandee and Ben decide it's best that they make tracks, and they leave in a mini-sub that travels through the now submerged streets of New York City until they're spotted by a frog rat. Yep, a frog rat. He's a rat in a scuba suit. They make their way away from him and through a cavern where they surface. However, they're quickly knocked out by two of the freakiest looking mallets I've ever seen and put into a cage and placed onto a train to an unknown destination. When they're brought into a strangely named duty depot, they're met with two captive members of Ben's research team who were also captured and are wearing similar energy protecting coveralls. Ben throws himself to the ground in order to activate his heart disc, as that happened earlier in the issue, and the energy blasts tear the ropes apart that were binding Commandee, and yet don't hurt him at all. He grabs a gun, but is quickly disarmed by a staff-wielding rat, but not Splinter from the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. The rat closes in on him, but Ben quickly takes the rat out, and the three steel-plated men make quick work of the rat gang and retreat. They make their way out and climb ropes to the previously seen dirigible, and Commandee, with nowhere else to go...
I got nowhere else to go! I got nothing else.
Also climbs up and joins them on their journey. And that's how issue 2 ends. And once again, I have to say, somehow this series hits my inner 12-year-old. the same kid who would be watching Planet of the Apes and just freaking out over how much I love it is the person who comes out at me while I'm reading these. So I think I have an inordinate amount of love for this. I don't know that I am totally objective. And it's not totally nostalgic because I didn't read that much Commandee when I was that age.
Yeah, but it's the environment you grew up in. The Planet of the Apes. This is Planet of the Apes to some extent.
To a large extent, except for the fact that he expanded it to basically all animals. It really is. And by expanding it to all animals, it opened up some storytelling opportunities, because now you could have all the different factions. Instead of just having, you know, the gorillas, the orangutans, and the chimpanzees, now you have the rat gang, you have the tiger gang, you have, you know, whatever animal you want to have a gang, you know, it's done. And clearly the great disaster not only mutated their vocal cords, but their physical being too, because they all became kind of humanoid.
Right. It's almost like if you didn't know any better, you would think it was like a genetic engineering project. Let's combine a man with a rat and see what happens.
And then you add to that, you know, my love of Kirby's art. And this is, I still think this is Kirby, you know, pretty close to the top of his game. It's, I don't think it's inked as well as I would like. I think, you know, it lacks a little of the detail. If you had Joe Sinnott ink it instead of Mike Royer, I think I would like it a lot more. But I'm still pretty happy with it. Overall, it just, you know, it hits on all cylinders for me.
You know what, and being slightly younger than you, for me, I get all the vibe of Thunder the Barbarian. Did you ever see that?
No, but I'm really familiar with it. I was aged out by then. But the one thing, my one trivia thing I know is Ookla from Thunder the Barbarian.
Right.
That is, that name came from the fact that Jack Kirby lived near UCLA.
I think I'd heard that. That's great.
That's my one Thunder trivia. And that was created a little bit after Kirby's, you know, had started to drop in the quality of his art and his creations. But at this point, like I said, I still think he was really pretty top notch. You know, it's Kirby's biggest thing is, you know, and Chris Tyler says it's drawing ugly people, which he did do very well. But I think that the angles that he chose and the facial expressions and all were very dynamic. And I think that is the key to his opera. And it just showed such imagination. You know?
Well, I think this is looking, I'm not a Kirby fan of his art. I'm going to be honest. This is much better than I feel a lot of it.
And I think that's because you are probably exposed to, like, superpowers, Kirby.
Yes. Yeah, I'm not a fan of that at all.
Yeah, because that's...
sure someone is going to be, oh my God, I can't believe you said that.
But that was after his artwork started to deteriorate.
I mean, that's like almost 15 years after this.
And there's also... I've said it with Steve Ditko, and I think there's an element of truth to it to Kirby, too, that as he became more legend, people became afraid to do too much with the inking on his work. And he was getting older, so his detail work probably wasn't as fine as it was when he was younger. And yet now you have inkers who are doing less with it. So, you know, that's not a good combination.
Right. Right.
But I think, like I said, at this point, I think Kirby's still, you know, I mean, at this point, the only thing is some of his faces were a little boxy. But other than that,
he was always a little boxy, I think, in the faces. I don't think this is bad.
I think it became more dramatic as he got older. I think if you look at Kirby, I think Kirby at his height is around the time of three-part Galactus series in the Fantastic Four, or in a lot of the Thor issues in the mid to high 100s. I think that's really when he kind of hit his peak and it the work really stands out. But, you know, I do think as he got older, like I said, the artwork became a little bit more boxy. And then that became even more pronounced as you got to, like, superpowers and stuff. But, you know, still, to me, this is still, like I said, I don't want to even be damning this at all because I really enjoy this.
Me too. I'm with you 100%. Do you want to go through the book?
Sure. Let me open to the beginning here. So we'll start at the cover. I don't think this is a great angle for the cover. It looks, you know, it's almost like, you know, no matter what I say, somebody's going to do something to prove me wrong. And I talk about how I like to have scenes that you see in the book and that we have that here. But I just feel like the angle that he chose, and again, I'm talking about the angles being so good. Here, I don't like the angle that he chose, looking up at the dirigible. I think it's a little confusing. I think the red is a little too stark. And I think Commandy's face could use a little more detail.
The pose reminds me of a gunfighter.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what he's shooting for there. No, no pun intended.
But
so we, but you know, we go ahead.
I was just going to say, but definitely, to some extent, is a scene from the book with some modification.
Right, and then Kirby gets very dramatic in his prose, and I've been critical of Kirby's writing style, but you know, at the top of the splash page, the world of Commandy is Earth AD after disaster. Somewhere in the past, a natural catastrophe of cataclysmic proportion had exposed the planet to an unknown period of intense radiation. When Commandy, the last of the underground bunker people, left for the surface, he found a changed world. Beasts had become as men. Men had slipped into the roles of lower order animals, and Commandy had shared their desperate lot, despairing lot, until a lucky encounter with new friends. He'll need them in the Year of the Rat. Like, it's very dramatic, and you can almost hear like William Conrad reading it at the beginning.
See, for me, I hear the guy who did the intro to Thunder the Barbarian. I keep waiting for a runaway planet between the Earth and the Moon.
See, I don't even know who did the voiceover on that.
Oh, I don't either, but I just hear it.
I'm going to take a very quick look and see if I can find it.
Now, I did a little research. I give kudos to them because this was published during the Year of the Rat.
Oh, cool.
Which was from February 15th, 1972 to February 2nd, 1973. So that's right in the wheelhouse.
So the narrator for Thunder the Barbarian was Dick Tufeld, T-U-F-E-L-D. I'm not sure what else he did. I'm trying to look.
So now, have you read through these books before, or just hit, you know, here and there?
Here and there. That's it. I did not. I never read it from beginning to end, which is one of the reasons why I'm actually a little excited about doing it. Yeah.
See, I haven't read any of it till now.
Okay, I'm going to interrupt again. I'm sorry, the non sequitur. But Dick Tufeld is best known as being the voice of the robot on Lost in Space.
Ah, danger, Will Robinson. Well, yeah. So now you all know what he sounds like.
Okay.
How do you like them apples?
So in when Kirby went over to DC from Marvel, that's when he started this practice of having an opening splash page and then having the second page, the second and third page, be one combined giant splash, which he did here. And that, see, in the Marvel books, I think you would have seen a little bit more detail in the background. We have a lot of white space in the background here. And the things that are drawn very well, but it almost feels like there's something missing.
It seems like, though, that's almost the trait of these books with the one color backgrounds on the covers and the clear backgrounds on the splash page. That may change.
Yeah, there's a lot of pages here where there's not much in the background other than solid color. And that is not really something that Kirby was known for, because if you remember, we've been critical in the past of Vince Coletta, who apparently erased a lot of background stuff to get things done quickly. And, you know, there's things where they showed Kirby where he had drawn all these detailed backgrounds and they never made it into the final book because, you know, Vince Coletta was trying to get it done quickly. So going into, you know, further into this, what do you think about how the Tigers immediately tear off the radioactive protection suit from him?
Yeah.
Not too bright. And then they say, hey, there's a button. Let's push it.
I looked at this and I don't know why I got a vibe of Metron off of the Ben Boxer with the suit.
And then he turns into the Silver Surfer.
Right.
When he's made into steel. It seems the way it's, like, they don't say it definitively, but it seems like he has some sort of time limit on staying in that steel, position, the steel motif that he might need to change back, you know, after a period of time, and then allow himself to kind of recoup his energy.
Right, he can't just stay like that. That's what I'm gathering.
Then we, you know, he's got an interesting little mini sub here, and I really, you know, I made a point of mentioning it, but I got a huge kick out of the frog rat, or the frog rats.
Well, that's, you know, subway system already has those.
Yeah.
Oh, I liked it, just to go back a second, the details they put in there on that jumbo splash page, the George Washington Bridge. Once you see the sign that says George Washington, if you're familiar with the bridge, it kind of does look like the George Washington Bridge. And on the page with the frog rat, you see the wreckage of the Circle Line.
Yeah.
So.
And I like when they're going through the streets and, you know, you could see that the buildings of Manhattan are underwater.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's kind of like just the right amount of attention to detail. It's not overly, you know, making you feel like you got to study to read the book, but it's giving you just enough to enjoy it. And right. What are these mallets that they hit them with? Are they mallets or are they like, you know, I said mallets, but now I'm thinking maybe they're like,
it looks hollow, like garbage
and they're catching
cans.
Them. And, yeah, they're catching them in them.
It's a big Harley Quinn mallet. She's going to pop out.
But then, you know, they're made unconscious by them, so I don't really, you know, I don't get it. Oh, and the rats are playing poker.
And he's cheating, because he's a rat.
Yeah.
It's very almost like a Western, to, you know, a certain aspect, where they're playing cards, one guy's cheating, he pulls his gun on him.
Yeah, it's got that, you know, what you call it, Firefly, you know, futuristic Western feel.
Yes, yes.
I did comment that the blast was enough to tear Commandy's ropes apart, but, you know, he's totally uninjured from it.
Well, he's the star of the show. You can't have him killed off.
No, but it just seems like, you know, he would at least get burned or something if it's enough to destroy the ropes that are binding him.
I'm more amazed that they still can operate some kind of a subway on the independent line.
Yeah, it's the IRT.
And what are they powering it with?
Oh, excuse me, the IND. Yeah, that's a good question.
Especially if the city's flooded.
There's some sort of electricity. That third rail is hopping.
I can tell you when.
And I only see two rails in the photo.
I can tell you when it floods, the subway's the first thing to get flooded.
Yeah. And then, you know, we meet up with Ben's two research partners, and I'm wondering how much we're going to get to know them as the story continues. Or are they potentially red shirts?
Yeah. Well, you know, you guys covered number one, and I read it recently, but it just seemed at the end of that book like they were going to just leave him there. And he just climbs up and, oh, you're coming along. Oh, okay. But
no, that's
like...
at the end of this one. That's not number one. That's this story. He just climbs up and goes with them.
Oops. You know, when you read three in a row.
Yeah, sometimes they start to blend. Now, what is this dirigible thing? Very strange looking.
Looks like they sewed a bunch of clothes together.
It's like a ship. It's like a Zeppelin. It's got the basket at the bottom that you know you could sit in. I don't really understand its workings very well.
Yeah, clearly it's but the thing is, it's so primitive looking, right?
Yeah.
But yet the mini sub they had was so advanced. And how did the mini sub get there?
And, you know, as they're flying away in the dirigible, the mini sub explodes. And they say, well, now it's been decommissioned. You would think that would be a precious commodity, that thing.
It's like almost James Bond, you know, burglar protection.
Yeah. And then at the end it says, let's see. That's why you must look for the next issue. It will reveal an astounding clue to the beginnings of Commandy Strange New World. And for conflict, Chaku, the Goliath of Gorillas. For adventure, the Astro Saga, and the sheer fright, the thing that grew on the moon.
Ta-da! But I'm just surprised they were going to just leave him there without even saying, do you want to come along?
Well, bye-bye.
Okay, we're out of here.
It's like they were hoping he wouldn't come along.
Oh, look, we have a stowaway. We see him climbing up the thing and everything.
I don't know. Speed up the ship, quick. Let's get out of here.
Cut the rope. So, what did we think of this?
Again, I'm not 100% sure that I'm objective on this, but
don't be objective.
being totally subjective, the cover I think is very well drawn, or mostly well drawn. I think the red is almost too bright. I think it could have been just a little more subtle. The colors are there's very little mixing to the colors. It's almost like coloring book drawn. Right. And again, I thought Commandy's face could have been a little better drawn, and I think the angle could have been better. So I can only go so high on this. I'm going to say a B minus. Still Kirby. Oh. The interior art, I think, is better than the cover art. Again, I think it could have been inked a little bit more, and I think the backgrounds could have been a little bit more. So I can't give it an A, but I'm going to give it a solid B. And the story, I just got a big kick out of the story. It seems to me strange to be giving Kirby higher grades on his story writing than his art, but I'm going to give him a B+ on the story, and overall I'm going to give the book a B.
Yeah, I'm with you pretty close, same ballpark. I kind of like the cover. I don't know why. There's just something I find appealing about it. And I went with the B on the cover. The interior art I liked as well. I gave that a slight bump up with a B+. And I did like the story. I thought it was solid. It moved at a good pace. I balled up the end of it a little bit, mixing it up there. But I gave that a B+ as well. So I'm giving it overall a B+.
So then we move on to The Thing That Grew on the Moon.
Oh, my goodness. So issue number 3, cover dated February of 1973, on sale December 12th, 1972. Remember that? December 12th. That's going to play in later. Cover price was a huge 20 cents, two thin dimes. Written and penciled by Jack Kirby, inked by Mike W. Arroyo. The Thing That Grew on the Moon is our chapter. In a scene that could have been ripped right out of the original Planet of the Apes, Commandy is confronted by gorilla soldiers while a herd of primitive humans cower in the background. Welcome to Las Vegas, Nevada, post-Great Disaster. Commandy fights back, surprising the gorillas with his ability to speak, think, and use a weapon. Unused to intelligent humans, the gorillas refer to Commandy as a doggy, presumably a reference to cattle being herded, and they call him a beast of burden. Falling to the strength and superior numbers of the gorillas, Commandy is captured. The gorillas expect that Commandy, with his ability to speak and think, will sell for a high price and think he's more valuable than an entire herd of humans. As they enter what Commandy christens Ape Town, USA, we are shown an odd gorilla city, complete with vine-like transit ropes allowing gorillas to swing their way through the city. People are used like beasts of burden, pulling carts. Suddenly, Commandy's captors find themselves confronted by a gorilla named Chaku, the Mighty. The ape invokes the right of challenge to claim the speaking human. Commandy convinces his captor to allow him to fight the massive ape. And he defeats him with a slingshot like David did to Goliath in the Bible. Commandy reveals he's not part of the local herd and has friends. The gorillas realize Commandy and potentially his armed friends may be a threat and plan to bring him before the council. Before they can move, Chaku rises, seeking revenge, and Commandy flees toward the diggings. Meanwhile, Commandy's friends, Ben Boxer and Renzi, explore a cavern containing the remains of Project Apollo, a facility for relics of lunar exploration. They are attacked by a rock-like creature with electrical powers. It apparently hatched from an object brought back from the moon. As they race through the wrecked facility, we see the artifacts from the moon missions that went through at least Apollo 20. In our timeline, the last mission was Apollo 17, launched on December 7th, 1972, 5 days before this book hit the stands. They come upon the remains of the creature's egg, which is labeled Porous Life Rock, possible silicon egg. Is it a relative of the Hoarder? Ben and Renzi transform themselves into their armored forms and prepare to do battle. Fission powers activate. That's what they should have added in. Entering the cavern from the opposite end is Commandy, with Chaku in hot pursuit. Through the ruins of Las Vegas, they race. The Golden Nugget and the Flamingo Casinos are referenced in the ruins. Chaku finally traps Commandy and gives him the choice to die at the hands of the rockbuster monster that stalks the place or beg for mercy. Suddenly, Chaku is attacked by the rockbuster himself, the same creature we know to be the moon creature. The fight becomes one to the death, which greatly weakens the structural integrity of the cavern. Down goes Chaku, and Commandy is next. Commandy is saved at the last minute by Renzi and Ben. The Rockbuster's assault begins to melt the walls of the cavern into lava. At the last moment, they are given the opportunity to escape by Chaku, who rises up in a rage, and with a feat of strength worthy of Samson, Chaku shoves the crumbling walls and causes the cavern to completely collapse, burying him and the Rockbuster under the earth. Ben and Renzi fission back to normal, and Commandy realizes that Chaku never harmed him, but merely wanted him as a toy. Which I don't know if that's any better, to be blunt with you.
Yeah, really.
Talk about a boy toy.
See, now, I don't know that we've seen the last of Chaku or the Rock Monster.
Oh, you mean they may return in a later episode?
But it's funny how they they present it as if they're done, which kind of brings me back to, like, you know, old comics, you know, of the Golden Age, where, you know, every time they'd face a villain, he would fall to his death, and then 3 months later, he'd be back. But it's well, the first thing that jumps out at me about this book is on the cover, is he fighting Chaku or King Kong?
It's King Kong.
Because look at the size difference.
He's going to pick him up and crawl to the top of Caesar's palace.
I mean, the way that the cover is laid out, Commandy is closer to the reader, Chaku is further back, and Commandy's doing his David and Goliath slingshot thing. But with him closer, the perspective should make him, you know, I understand Chaku's bigger than him, but the perspective should be to create the illusion of Commandy being closer to his size, since he's closer to the viewer. In this image, he's tiny.
Well, figure if Chuck, who was 8 feet tall, because Commandy's about what, half his.
I would say Commandy's probably supposed to be about 5'7", something like that. So he's not supposed to be fully grown yet. He's a teenager.
Right. Yeah, they're really playing up the David and Goliath in this.
You could almost see if you look at Commandy's, the way he's drawn on the cover, and you draw lines kind of connecting his 2 feet and going across, and then from the back of his right leg, kind of going up his back and you know at that angle, you could almost see where the perspective gives you the size of Chaku in the picture, which I would imagine is what Kirby actually did, but it's just deceptive because of the way it's drawn, and it doesn't create the right angle.
Do you know what this cover reminds me of? Color Forms.
We've had a few covers over the years that look that way, where it's almost like, okay, just place the character where you want. They're drawn totally independent of each other, and it doesn't have the feel like they belong together.
Particularly Commandy. He looks like you could peel him right off the page and stick him somewhere else.
Which also goes to what I was talking about in the last issue with some of the coloring being just a little too bright and a little bit too monochromatic in each color. There's not, there's not like grades of the color where the shadows are making a difference or anything like that. I'm not thrilled about the coloring.
No, the coloring is not. It's almost like they did this cover and they told him, we need to get rid of this light blue ink. We have a tremendous amount in stock. Just make it as shades of light blue as you possibly can.
I also think there's an element of, hey, we're unashamedly ripping off Planet of the Apes. We need to do a Commandy cover with a giant ape on the cover.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're already in the third issue and you haven't done an ape yet, Jack. Come on, you got to do apes.
Well, this is only what, 3 years after the original? Is it 69?
The original was 1968.
68. So it's 4 years after that picture. And they're cranking them out now.
And yeah, we're in the throes of the sequels at this point.
I mean, there is so much stuff in this book. I mean, the ape, the first ape you see in the book, the helmet is very reminiscent of the helmets the gorillas wore. The coloring's different, but you could almost see if this was a Marvel comic based on Planet of the Apes, this is what they would have looked like.
Right. And I got to tell you, I was taken aback a little bit going into the beginning of this. Like, wait a minute, how does this pick up from where we left off in the last issue? He was on the dirigible flying away with them. How is he, all on his own now?
I was a little annoyed when I started reading this book. I was like, don't tell me that the stories are going to be independent and it's just going to pick up at some later point.
Yeah, that's like almost what it feels like. It's almost right. What it feels like. And that would have been just crazy, in this era of comics to not have an ongoing narrative. And then, cut to the big double splash page. It definitely feels like the scenes in the beginning of the Planet of the Apes when the gorillas first come out in the fields and are hurting the humans.
Yes. I'm also starting to see a pattern that don't bother giving Commandy a gun because he seems to always get disarmed.
Yeah. And he's not he doesn't have great aim, apparently.
No.
He's got stormtrooper aim.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. It is pretty cool, though, the way that developed. I like the sequence where he's firing the gun, the gorilla's jumping out of the way, and then, when he thinks he's got everything going for him, the two apes just kind of come up behind him and each grab an arm.
These apes don't seem as brutal as the gorillas in Planet of the Apes. You have that opening scene where they're basically just hunting the people and pretty much killing them. Whereas this, it seems like they're cattle. We're going to round them up and, put them to work, pulling the carts and stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a dumb animal.
But this is subject to the Comics Code Authority, too.
Correct. Yeah.
So they have to be a little careful on where they go with some of this stuff. Now then we have chapter two opening up with another 2-page splash. And again, I have issues with the coloring here. But if this page was colored right, I think this could be a spectacular image.
It's very, I mean, it looks like something out of Where the Forever People Live.
Oh, yeah, on Apocalypse.
Right.
Right? Don't they live on Apocalypse?
I think so. I'm not versed, but I've seen pictures.
But this is really,
it looks it, like.
There's a lot of activity going on this picture, on these pages. And like again, I'm not happy with the coloring on it. But other than that, if this page was colored right, I think it would be almost, you know, it's not like I'd want to hang it in my house, but it's almost poster worthy type art.
And what's funny is with all the high tech stuff that appears, I mean, it looks high tech, the buildings to some extent. And then yeah. You have the ropes swinging down like vines that they, oh, there's a lot of traffic on the transit vines tonight.
Yeah. Now the ape drawn in the bottom middle of the second page, again, coloring issues, looks like a human in that suit.
Yeah.
The coloring on the face. Then we meet Chaku in his big red diaper.
He's got to be the toughest guy in the village to wear an outfit like that.
And everybody's afraid to make fun of him. I guess it's supposed to be like a sumo wrestler garb.
I guess. I don't know.
He's got the very cool headband and he's got the boots.
I got a very, with the headband and the wristbands, I got like an Indian vibe from that.
That could be. So now Commandy hits him with the slingshot, but I don't think the slingshot takes him out. I think what they're trying to give you is, because he's lifting up the giant granite block, and I think when Commandy hits him with the slingshot, that the block drops and hits him in the head.
Oh. See, I took it that it was the rock that just stunned him. Because he gets up pretty quick.
Mm-hmm.
He's only down a short period.
Yeah. Yeah, but I don't know. I just thought that, like, a rock by itself wouldn't be enough to take him out. Even like, for a short period.
It's like a batarang.
Yeah.
I throw a batarang at it.
Or a rocket.
I like the gorillas seem to be, I'm going to say they're fairly intelligent because they start to put things together pretty quick. Oh, you know, this guy can speak. He was armed with a gun. He's got friends coming. This may be a problem. We want to turn him into the council and see what Dr. Zaius is going to come up with.
Well, that's more clever than a lot of similar creatures would be in these books.
Yeah.
You know, in a lot of these books, they'd just be like, nah, we'll just keep him here ourselves.
Right. I was being completely serious. I think they're pretty bright.
Yeah, no, they are. And I think there's almost kind of a good storytelling element to the fact that Chaku's kind of the bully of the ape city. And, you know, and they all got to tiptoe around him a little bit. And even, you know, when he's awake, the two other apes are like, they're like, we got to get out of here.
He's a problem.
He's a problem, but he has a sense of honor, apparently.
Yeah, well, towards the end, I think he has a sense of honor. In this part, the whole, you know, oh, the challenge, I'm entitled to the challenge. Yeah, because you're the big bully in the group.
Well, yeah. So, we have the, you know, they're in the Badlands, and we meet up, we get a name for Renzi. Do we ever get a name for the other guy?
What, Ben Boxer?
Well, no, Ben Boxer we know, and there's three of them. Right. The third guy, do we ever get a name for him?
If we did, I missed it, because I only had those two names.
Yeah, me too. So, you know, at least now that we join them and we get an understanding that Commandy was with them and he went out on his own and, you know, Ben's worried about him. So, you know, at least it picks up the story where we, you know, where we had been.
It took... I now, do you think he did that on purpose? that we didn't get to that point until this far into, because it's a significant ways into the story. It's more than a third of the book before we get to them.
Yeah, no, it's about the halfway mark. Yeah, I do think he did it on purpose. The question is, was it a good thing that he did it?
Right.
I'm not sure. Because I was confused by it at first. And I found it like it annoyed me a little bit that the story started and we didn't have an explanation. And it's not like when we got an explanation, I thought, oh, okay, that's why you didn't tell us. I don't see a reason to not tell us.
It almost seems like
you could have just done it in the narration.
He was writing this and went, oh my God, I forgot about those guys.
But I think you could have just done it in the narration. You know, Commandy, you know, you say something that he was out on a scouting mission, mm-hmm. or something like that. And then
you just
pick it up from there. Yeah.
So I don't know why they did it that way, but I'm glad he picked it up because that did bother me.
Yeah. And then we meet the Rockbuster creature who, you know, looks like a giant beetle.
Yeah.
And to some extent, he looks like he's rock, and to some extent, he looks like he's very smooth. Like his arms look smooth.
He's Little Darkseid's dog.
And then I agree with you, what your commentary as you were reading it about it being cool that they have the Apollo stuff and, you know, all laid out around them.
Now, this, I wanted to ask you about this. And I'm not being a smart aleck in the least. Clearly,
I'll be the judge of that.
You have memories of when they went to the moon.
Right? Yes, some. Yes.
And I envy you for that, because I just missed it. I was one when the last trip went. And I think that's such a cool thing that you got to see that live happening.
I have memories of being at, you know, with my mom and dad at my aunt and uncle's house and the TV being on and them showing them walking on the moon.
See, to me, that's to see it live is the coolest
and,
thing.
And, you know, when you think about it, I was 6 years old at the time, six, maybe seven. I'm trying, what date was it that we walked on the moon? You know,
69, July of 69.
July, yes. Yeah, so I was not quite 7 years old yet. So for me to have that memory burnt in, you know, it was a significant event.
You know, they're discussing this Artemis flight that's supposed to go to the moon. I know this is, we're going on top.
Non sequiturs are okay. We call them tangents.
They're supposed to go back to the moon, and I think 25 or something like that. I already told my cousin, when that thing launches, you know, when it's on its way, we find out what day it's going to land, and we take off from work if we have to. To watch that live on television, to see them land on the moon.
I won't have to take off from work.
I know you won't have to take off. Maybe we'll come out to your house and watch it.
You're invited.
But I love all the stuff they have in the museum. I'm guessing this is supposed to be either a museum or some kind of a storage facility. But I don't know why they'd have it in Nevada, unless it's supposed to be Area 51.
Maybe. You know what? Maybe. I didn't think of that. I'm thinking it's a museum because there's the, you know, the labels, which seem to be a little basic. If it was actually a storage facility, I think there'd be more scientific names or whatever. And you wouldn't put, like, lunar glider. You know, I mean, you wouldn't have that in a storage facility. Or a poster saying, you know, Apollo 25-year field trip. You wouldn't hang up a poster like that or have a spacesuit up against a wall like that. This has got to be a museum.
Yeah. This is one of those examples of, like, Star Trek, where I guess they figured, oh, we're going to keep going. This is going to go into the future.
I could see why they would think that. I would have at the time.
I would have too.
But I guess they felt like, with the technology being what it was, that they weren't getting anything. They weren't bringing back any useful information that they hadn't brought back in previous trips.
It's so all about dollars and cents.
Yeah, so it wasn't worth it for them. It wasn't worth it for them because they didn't have something to monetize. Mm-hmm. If they were bringing back some form of information or scientific data that was going to advance things, eventually that would have been monetized.
Yeah.
So now when he comes across, when Commandes comes across the cars on the road, and they show two skeletons, are those human skeletons or ape skeletons?
Look at the shape of the head. They look like apes.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. But then I'm wondering, you know, if that was at the great disaster, the apes wouldn't have walked, spoken yet or driven cars. So I don't know.
Are they trying to say that the apes became Satan before the great disaster?
Yeah, no, I'm thinking the great disaster had something to do with all the animals becoming sentient and speak, you know, able to speak.
Well,
and,
perhaps
and
they
be mutated, really.
Perhaps they were just killed there.
Maybe. There's a lot of possibilities. So then Chaku jumps Commandy, but then he's taken out by the Rockbuster. And where was the comment here? Here, on the second page, after he's taken out by the Rockbuster, it says, "The mighty simian staggers and falls, mortally wounded." I'm not sure Kirby knows what mortally wounded means, because it meant he was supposed to die. And I'm not so sure he dies.
I think I'm going to no prize it that he was on. He was terminal. He was going to die, but he got that last surge of adrenaline that I'm going to take him with me.
Yeah, but then, like I said, I don't know for a fact that he goes on beyond this story, but I'm thinking he does.
Well, then we can for sure say he doesn't know what the word means.
I feel like, what's his name, Mandy Patinkin in The Princess Bride. I'm not sure you know what that word means. I'm going to take a look now. I'm going to the DC wiki
page. Are you
going to
spoil this?
Oh, no. You know what? I am going to spoil. I just looked at the DC wiki page for this issue. And it says, you know, under characters, I lost it now. It says, Chaku, single appearance, dies.
Oh, so he dies.
So my theory that he's going to be back is wrong. And then Kirby is, when he said he was mortally wounded, that doesn't mean you have to die that second. So I take back everything I said about Kirby mishandling that word.
You know, he could have also had like a blood infection. It could have been very slow, very painful, taking years to go. It's what kills him. It just takes a really long time.
I'm honestly disappointed that we're not going to see him again.
Did you look up and make sure there's no son of Chaku that returns?
I didn't look that up. But, you know, I especially, like you said, at the end when he forces himself up to destroy the enemy, which is what he says, you know, that he's not giving up, and he Samson like pushes the pillars to make
the structure collapse
on top of the rock beater. It's a cool moment, almost cinematic in the way that it's presented.
This is a book with two biblical references.
Well, we have the Samson one.
And David.
Oh, and David and Goliath, yeah. You're right. And then, you know, and then Commandy, he just wanted me as a toy. Well, I, you know, he wanted you as a toy, like a 2-year-old who pulls the arms off of the action figure that you give him.
For all we know, it could be like George. Is it George? Lenny and Of Mice and Men.
Yeah.
I just want to pet the boy.
And crush his skull.
And crush his skull. Love him and hug him. You know, like the Bugs Bunny version. Yeah, I want to love him and hug him.
He's the abominable snowman.
Did you know Chaco's bounce?
So, anything else, or are we going to rate this?
Just that last scene where they fission back to human form. It looks like they're beaming up to the Enterprise.
And even the scene, the one after that, when they're, you know, kind of looking back on then when he says that he, you know, whoa, he just wanted to use a toy. It feels like the end of a Star Trek episode.
Yeah, it does. Well, they're all red shirts, so.
Yeah.
You're lucky you got off the planet alive.
So how are we rating this one?
Oh, my God. What are we going to do? The cover on this one, I didn't care for the cover. It's like I said, it reminds me of a color form set. Push the light blue, aqua blue. I'm not good at determining the colors. The size problem with Chaku. To be blunt, the whole sumo diaper makes me feel a little bit uncomfortable. And he's missing his wristbands as well. I'm going to give the cover a C-.
Ooh.
I was tempted to go even lower, but I don't want to really kill it.
You give it whatever you think it deserves.
The interior art is slightly... It's more than slightly better. I really get, like I said earlier, that this reminds me of almost the artwork you'd find in a Marvel Planet of the Apes book from the early 70s. So of its time, I think it's decent. I'm going to give the interior art a solid B. The story, I thought it was pretty good. I was annoyed in the beginning because I thought they were dropping the whole storyline from the last book. And when they didn't, they just held back on it. I was pleased with that. I liked the way they portrayed the gorillas, that they were more intelligent than you would expect them to be. And I got a kick out of the two biblical references. I'm giving the story a solid B+. For an overall grade of a B- on the book. Cover's what brought it down.
Okay, I'm not as down on the cover as you are. I am bothered by the perspective, the size perspective. And once again, I'm not crazy about the coloring. But other than that, I don't really have a problem with it. I kind of think I understand the whole idea of, hey, let's get an ape front and center here. You know, this is what we're trying to, you know, to make our money on. So let's not even try and hide it. Let's go right to the apes. So I'm gonna say C+ on the cover. It's not great, but I don't think it's bad. The interior art I do think is superior to the last issue. Again, I'm not crazy about the coloring. I think it's a little too monochromatic at spots, and it's a little too bright. I think this book could do with just a little bit more shadow and. You know, of a little bit more, just a little bit more of a grim feeling to it, because it almost feels too upbeat for a post-apocalyptic world. I'm gonna say a B+ on the interior art. I think it's pretty solid. The story, again, I think this story is better than the last issue. Definitely. I think it gives you a good thing with the apes. It gives you the science fiction element with this rock crusher creature, rock buster. It gives you some, you know, some thoughtful moments. I'm going to say an A- on the story. And overall, I'm going to give the book a solid B. Almost a B+ for me, but just a B.
Oh, good. Thanks. So now just before we wrap this up, it seems now from the books we've read that this was strictly a natural disaster. I don't know why. I kind of thought war was a possibility.
I think, and I don't know for sure, but I think they build on this as it goes on. And I think that they start to develop a little bit more of what this disaster, the great disaster, was. And I don't think it's, at least the way it gets built up, I don't think it's a simple thing that occurs.
Right.
You know, I don't know exactly where it's going to go, and that's cool. We're going to have fun finding out. But I do think it's, you know, I know, you know, we talked about last time about, you know, that there's a connection with OMAC. So I think there's definitely going to be more going on than we see on its face. And I think that's the way of a lot of Kirby concepts. I think he came up with the concepts and he puts them out there, and then eventually other creators take them and run with them a little bit and give them even a little bit more development than what he did. I think, you know, that happened with the New Gods. I think it's happened with the Eternals. I think it happened with a lot of the cosmic stuff that Kirby did in the FF with, you know, the Sentry and Ronin, the Kree and the Skrulls and all of this stuff. You know, and I am loath to just start saying Kirby, Kirby, Kirby when it comes to that, because I do believe Stan Lee was, you know, a big factor in everything as well. And I don't like when people minimize his role in doing these things. But a lot of it conceptually, I think, comes from Kirby's just crazily overactive imagination. And I think it's seen here. And I think eventually he's going to leave this book, and I think other writers are going to take what he did and kind of try and build on it. And I think that's what we're going to see with this great disaster.
It'll be interesting to see when someone else comes in, how it changes the book.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're going to get there. This is going to be another ongoing thing, like Avengers Spotlight, like the Origins issues, like the Thing Hulk retrospective. The Commandy retrospective is going to be, you know, when Dave and I get to the next issues, we get to the next issues. I don't know, you know, how regularly or how, you know, far apart they're going to be. But we are excited about doing it, so hopefully we'll get moving along.
Absolutely, definitely. This was a great idea.
So, in the meanwhile, we'll see you at Command D.
Goodbye.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiMonzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.